Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the wasp in my visor, it's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, Dave, how's things?
I'm all right, thank you. And you yourself?
Very, very excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, you're looking very studious today with your glasses on, Mr. Plato.
Do I not? Do I normally have them on? Don't I?
Well,
otherwise
you sometimes
can't see.
Well, you. So I just they're particularly noticeable today, I think. I wonder whether it will set a trend for today's guest, who also may follow suit in the studious looks.
I've just spotted him out the corner of my eye. Maybe slip some on just to lift his IQ. But obviously, we don't want to hear from him just yet.
No.
Anyway,
we don't.
Our guest today. Well, do you know what? Since I was a wee lad, and since he was a wee lad. We've been friends since the early 80s. Now, he's most definitely a man that we can definitely describe as one of motor racing's royalty. Mm-hmm. From Formula One to Le Mans and everything in between. It is, of course, my old pal, Mr. Johnny Herbert.
You are very right. We go back a very, very, very long way.
Well, this was going to be my opening gambit, Johnny. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you on. I know that your paths have crossed many, many times, but exactly when they first crossed is something that I'm unsure about. So please fill me in.
Well, do you know what? There's so many lovely stories. You know, we started off in karting. I mean, you a bit before me, but I started in 1980. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was the national championship called the Super One Series, which we were charged up and down the country. My mum and dad became friends with Bob and Jane, Johnny's parents and his sister, mm-hmm. Sarah. And we were kind of just mates, weren't we? We were like family mates. Johnny was always, you know, an age bracket above me, mm-hmm. because he's, you know, 3 years older. And it just goes back. I mean, there's so many fantastic stories, isn't there? I mean, Wombwell, do you remember all the scrapping which used to go on up the pubs on the Saturday night?
Yes, exactly. I remember
that
particular one at the Wombwell one at the pub at the top.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And me standing on a table after we'd had a couple of locals having a chat with Lee Cramner's sister. I do remember one of the girls that was up there.
Yeah, Julie.
Yes. Julie, yeah. That's it, Julie, yes. Yeah, I remember that. A little sort of scrap happened in the pub.
Just to fill you in, Johnny, we weren't drinking at this age because we were young, but obviously on a Saturday night, you know, karting, I mean, it's still probably like it is today, but, you know, there was like a big campsite. We'd all be camping in our, you know...
Caravans.
Caravans and tents.
Caravans. And things have changed, Jason. Things have changed.
Yeah. Oh, haven't they just? And do you know what? A few of us would just kick around and walk up into town. And this was in the middle of darkest Yorkshire. South Yorkshire, I think it was.
Yeah. It's all mining country around there, isn't it, Wombwell?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm.
Yes.
And there'd often be a bit of aggro. And somehow we'd find ourselves right in the middle of it.
Middle of it.
But talking of aggro... You know, the interplay between son and dad in karting is quite an interesting one. And Johnny's setup was very similar to mine in that his dad was his number one mechanic, mm-hmm. used to prepare everything. And there'd often be some rucks. Do you remember, Johnny, the one time at Wombwell where you and your dad had a ruck and you threw a spanner at him and he ducked and it went through the side of your car?
It did. It did.
Do you remember?
And the hole got covered with a shell sticker. After that. So, yes, there were quite a few strops, I suppose, over the year. I remember another one actually in Italy when we were at Jesolo, and I was really, really miffed with my performance. And I remember stamping on the track rod at the front. And then Dad forced me to sort of change it. He said, "I ain't changing it. You change it. You broke it. You're doing it." So those scraps happened all the way through our career. But to be honest, Jason, we learnt one hell of a lot in that time period, and it was very, very positive for both of us, I think, for our racing careers as they blossomed in slightly different ways.
Well, absolutely, and it sets you up. It kind of instills racecraft in your system where you just do it subconsciously. And I think anyone that comes from karting, they all turn, you know, anyone that's successful like you were, Johnny, the racing element is just, you've got that covered off. Mm-hmm. So So after karting, you went Formula Ford, what, 85, somewhere around there?
80, well, actually, my first Formula Ford race was 1983, the Formula Ford Festival. That was my actual first racing experience, which is like the World Cup of Formula Ford. So it was probably the most stupid thing I did, but it was the most frustrating thing I did as well, Jason, because from karts, it's all nippy and quick and responsive and quite powerful. And a Formula Ford, lazy, slow, bloody awful. Yeah. Awful things, yeah. Hated the things, yeah. Took me a long time before I found what I was wanting. And I suppose that actually happened in Formula 3000, actually.
And what sort of age are you at this point? Obviously, I'm imagining you both being kids with your karting. At what point are you going into proper single-seater cars?
Well, 19, I think I was. I think I was 19. So that was, so I was sort of quite late in modern terms.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was just the process that we went through to get to that point of having someone who was able to back us and back me to give me that chance of getting into Formula Ford. And of course, on that journey, hopefully, towards Formula One. But as Jason knows, it's all about trying to get the success. And the success is something that is damn hard. You have to work so hard at being able to get yourself in a position to achieve that. And once you get that success, in those days, just for example, when I met that guy with no hair, what's his name? Eddie Jordan. And he... Your face.
I've got a question for you in a minute.
Yes, do. I met him at the Grosvenor Awards, which was like the Autosport Awards that we have today. Mm-hmm. And basically, we were back to back on two separate tables. And he sort of asked me, has anybody spoken to me about not the 1987 season? And I said, no one's actually spoken to me yet, surprisingly, because I'd done a couple of races successfully in 86. And by the end of that evening, on the back of a napkin, we actually signed a deal to do 87. Right? So he was out there to get that talent. And that's where it's slightly different now. There isn't that ability. You could be the best thing on the planet. You're like Senna. You're like Alain Prost, Ayrton Senna, Michael Schumacher, all mingled into one. How much budget you got? It's a very, very different... See, it is, isn't it, James? It's a very different world that we live in at the moment. But I was very successful at each step that I took, and that helped me always get the backing.
You won that first year with EJ in F3, didn't
you? That's right, exactly. Which was and he hadn't actually won the championship in Formula 3, so it was something he'd been hunting for a good few years. And then, finally, he chose the right man.
Johnny, following the success with Eddie Jordan then in 1987 comes the crash at Brands Hatch in 1988 that obviously could have been career-ending, at the very least, I guess, was a huge turning point in your career. You defied the odds to not only rehabilitate yourself and return to racing the following year, but return to racing with your first foray in Formula One. Would you say that that sequence of events over that period of months was perhaps your greatest achievement?
In some ways, when I look back for the state I was in or the state of my feet, but I was very lucky. It's one of those things, and I think Jason sort of will understand it. You've always got this inner belief and want to try and get yourself in the best car that you possibly could. And of course, the Formula 3000 accident was before Formula One, but that light was still lit. And when Peter Collins took up the option on the contract that I had, who was a team manager at the time, that gave me a massive lift to be able to work as hard as I possibly could. And I have to say, I worked myself quite literally to the bone to get myself ready for that first Grand Prix that I had in Rio. Was I 100% ready? Absolutely not. It probably took me another 2.5 years before I was back to as good as I could be. But the circuit, Rio de Janeiro, was just the perfect track for me, weirdly, because I didn't find it too difficult. It hurt, yes, but the whole flow of the circuit was just something that it suited me. And I look back now, and even I go, wow, how the hell you did that, I really don't know. But I think it was just all that graft to get myself there, mentally being in the right position to try and grab this opportunity, and I definitely grabbed it.
Well, it's amazing when you're in the zone, how powerful this is to blank everything out. It's amazing, isn't it? What you can actually do when you need it to do it.
Yeah, well, the only thing that was different, Jason, is before I had that accident, I always believed I could beat anybody, anywhere, any car, any condition. And I thoroughly believe that. Did you have the same thought process? No, I didn't think you did. But after the accident, that all disappeared. I never had that sort of belief again. Yeah, there was a lot of things that changed because I would always go into a braking zone, for example, and I would just do it visually. I would take all the 180 degree view that I've got and absorb it through my eyes to my brain. And that would be my breaking point, my turning point, my apex clipping and the exit clipping. And then after the accident, I actually had to do points. It was a breaking point. It was then to the apex. Then it changed a lot. It wasn't as natural.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it wasn't as natural as it
was before. And did that remain? And did that remain throughout your career? Or did it ever come back?
It came back once. And I have no idea why. I wish I knew why, which was Malaysia 99 when I was in the Stewart. And that, it weird, very weird.
Jason, we've spoken about this before, haven't we, in terms of, I guess for want of a better term, it's a bit like losing your bottle a little bit. You know, it's that fear. Do you think that the crash sort of made you more aware of your own mortality and therefore it changed the way you approach stuff?
No, I think before the accident, it was always, it's never going to happen to me. And then, of course, it happened. But then even after that, I thought, well, it's never going to happen to me again. And I think there are certain characters that can deal with it. It's almost like I say, with all the dangers that are involved with driving, you can't think about the danger. As soon as you start thinking about the danger, you'll never be able to get the best out of yourself. You'll be backing off through quick corners or whatever it may be. So it's almost like you put it in the back of your head in a little tiny box, you lock it and you throw away the key. You cannot allow the fear factor to come into play. As soon as it does, you're done.
See, that's really interesting you say about how you would visualise a corner and then how you then change into using little markers. Because I've never ever used markers, and yet I know very good drivers that do, and I could never understand how they could actually take their eye off, their mind off what you see to look for something and join the dots up. I could never get my head around that. I don't drive that way. I drive, you know, I just see and I feel and I retune. You know, if I brake too early, I don't go, all right, there's a tuft of grass. I just retune myself to brake a bit later.
Yes, the next time.
So that's really interesting that you switch to that. Really intrigued by that.
Well, I had to switch.
I mean, it bloody worked.
It worked. But but as you know, it's much easier when you just do it visually. So much easier because you're not having to think about anything. You're actually thinking of your steps ahead. You shouldn't need to, or you don't want to try and have those steps because steps are a little bit awkward and not flowing. And I found it a little bit more tougher afterwards. But it's interesting that you do the same thing because you're quite rare. They're quite rare. There's not many that have this ability to do that. And just very quickly, I remember walking around the circuit with Lewis Hamilton a good few years ago now. And I just sort of asked him as we were walking up towards Copse, just for example. And I said, what do you look at when you go into Copse? And he went, I don't know. I don't really look at anything. And it's exactly that.
Is that right?
But they're quite rare. They're quite rare. Or special. You're very special.
And you are too, mate. I've got a really interesting thing, which is probably very similar, but in different sports. We did some filming a few years ago with Ronnie O'Sullivan. And he's like a superhero to me. And actually to Tiff as well. And I remember Tiff's, you know what Tiff's like? Oh, right, let's analyse it. Let's make a spreadsheet. And he said in the garage one day, as we're waiting for the crew to set up a camera, he said, so, Ronnie, you know when you're on the you know you're about to take a shot. What are you looking at? Are you looking at the cue ball? Are you looking at the pocket? And he just said, "I don't know what you mean." He said, "I just hit the ball." And I guess it's a similar thing.
It's the same.
I guess it's it's a similar thing. Or maybe golfers. You know how we play golf badly.
Yes.
But we analyse everything and do it in bits. They just, I guess it's just a natural thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Again, it's like I said, it's a game you say about that on a snooker table. It's probably that 180 degree of taking in everything. It's not just the ball, the cue, the ball, the pockets, the table itself. You actually take in the crowd and the grandstand that may be there. You absorb all that and then you know exactly where you are. And then you have that natural, raw, natural ability, you know, to do it, you know, either in a car, on a snooker table, or even on a tennis court.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I think both of those examples, both in Lewis and in Ronnie, you know, people that actually perform in their sport so instinctively.
Yes.
I would imagine, it's one of those things where, you know, what do I think about? What do I look about? Actually, I've no idea until I'm actually there in the moment, because it is just that natural ability. Johnny, going back, who were your heroes then growing up when you were little? Who were your motorsport idols?
Probably the one that always stood out for me was Gilles Villeneuve.
Okay.
And Gilles, because I think he was just completely bonkers, and it didn't matter if he had four wheels on his wagon, two or three, he'd still drive the flipping wheels off of the thing. And he was always so exciting to watch, sideways on the circuit. He's, you know, he had such a high risk factor as well, very, very controlled as well. Very sad when he had the accident, obviously, in Zolder. But it was you, because I wanted to be like that. I wanted to be someone who could sort of do anything with that car, whatever that car may be.
Me too. Identical.
Yeah. What, in terms of your hero as well?
Yeah.
Really? And it was that a sort of character thing then, as you describe, you know, sort of being a bit of a maverick, just being so natural and charismatic, I suppose?
He was just, there was something really special, quite special about him. The way, you know, the way you could look at the attitude of his car, and he was exciting. You know, he seemed to be the only one, which probably is unfair, but he seemed to be the only one in my mind that I wanted to be like.
Yeah.
Much better looking than the pair of us. That's clearly why you're
as well as.
And he drove a Ferrari.
But
there was something really special about him. Really, really charismatic.
Yeah. And even when you look at videos, that Dijon race they had with Rennie Arnoux and that lap side by side, banging wheels. But it was that was the excitement. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I didn't do it very well, but I tried.
Do you know what? I'm really good mates with Jody Scheckter, and I found it really awkward to talk to Jody because that was his teammate. And do you know what? When I did, you know, say, look, you know, yes, I thought you were great, Jody, but, you know, my hero was Gilles. And do you know what? He turned around and said, do you know what? I thought he was cool as well.
I think many did in that era, Jason. I think there was just, you know, there was just such a, I don't know, that's something special about the man. And it's a shame that we both never met him, but it's still good to see a couple of those videos looking back.
So out of all the circuits, I mean, a crazy one to even ask, because I bet there's a few.
Yeah.
Come on, what circuit, even a karting circuit perhaps, would you, if you were given the chance to go back and drive it today in a car or machine of your choice, give us your top three.
Well, Suzuka. Yeah. I still thoroughly am in awe with what the drivers do when they go back there with these modern crazy cars that they've got. The speed those things go around that circuit is pretty mind-blowing. But it's just an old-school circuit. The barriers in most places are still quite close to the curb, which I think is all part and parcel of what it should be all about. So I still love what Suzuka is about. Le Mans, I have to say Le Mans. I find it... It's really weird. It's not a particularly difficult circuit to learn, but it's a damn difficult circuit to actually get right. It's a real proper challenge. I never did the old Mulsanne. I think that's probably one part of it I wish I'd had a go on, just to see how scary that was, waiting for something to happen down that sort of Mulsanne straight. But Le Mans is always something special. And I do have to say, and I do like it again, because it's old school, Road America. In the States.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
Proper tracks.
Love that. Proper track. Just it's a challenge. It was always about the challenge. And I could go on. You know, Mosport is another one that's really, you know, fantastic. Old school at the same time. And of course, you've got Brands Hatch, which has always been something special. And Silverstone's been very good because it's changed so much, as we know, Jason, over the years. But I think actually we've got a pretty good challenging track today. So that's more than three.
It's funny, you know, Dave, that proper drivers, we all like the barriers to be close, and we don't really want gravel traps.
No.
And we want, it's got to be a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the mind game, isn't it?
It's
the mind
game. You've got to feel the risk, haven't you?
Yes, you have.
I suppose what you're saying is that perhaps, you know, when, as you know, if this is the way that you've learnt your craft in the more old-fashioned ways with barriers close there, is that then when you do put a gravel trap and a runoff there, does it almost, I don't know how to describe it, but it doesn't give you that edge that you perhaps had when you know that there is genuine danger and genuine fear there?
Well, it was a thrill to me. It was that thrill of knowing that if I got it slightly wrong, I was going to pay a penalty for doing that. But that was the challenge. The challenge was to be on that edge. You know, we get all this sort of silliness with all track limits that are going on. And a lot of fans actually don't like it because it's ridiculous that a driver is losing his lap time. You go, well, no, that's the skill. Austin made me chuckle because he always used to be, same with you, Jason, all the way through both of our careers. It was always the curb. We actually probably did actually cross the white line. But the curb was actually what we played with as far as the track limits go. But then in Austin, it was like, well, yeah, it's a bit difficult at turn 19. So we're paint a thicker line. And you sort of go, well, what does that achieve? It doesn't achieve anything.
Anything.
And you go, my Lord, is that where we've got to? The challenge is to be between those white lines. And I think the likes of Max and Lewis and Ayrton Senna and Michael Schumacher, maybe Michael would probably cross it a little bit more, Mika Hakkinen, etc., that's where they would be so special and be able to do it in a qualifying situation, in a race situation. And there are others that are on the circuit even today that can't do it as consistent as as the very unique special ones like Max and Lewis at the present time.
Johnny, you raced with Jason as kids in karting, and then as I recall, or as my research would show me, that in 2009, you raced together again in the Touring Car Championships.
I'm not sure that's true. I don't think Johnny was racing himself.
I believe there was an incident at Silverstone where it was described to me that you were warmly welcomed into touring cars by a certain Mr. Jason Plato.
It was a snog. It was a little car snog.
It was a damn aggressive snog, if that's what you call it. Snog. My Lord almighty. And I'll tell you what, everybody, he knocked me, spun me round. It was my very first race in touring car. I'm still talking, Jason. It was my first race in touring car. He spins me around. He's never said sorry.
That's absolute nonsense. Don't give me those blue eyes of yours.
Do you remember what you said? It wasn't my fault. That's not saying sorry.
Yeah, probably. I was looking the other way, Your Honour.
Yes, I know you were looking the other way. I'm very aware of that, Jason Plato.
To be honest, I did put my hands up to that. I did. It wasn't my intention.
Not in front of me.
Get out of the way.
It wasn't. I tell you what, with everything that I've done in my career, I bloody hated those things. Front wheel drive.
Did you?
No sense to me whatsoever. I'd been spoiled for too long.
Yeah, so I was going to say, was it an enjoyable series for you? Obviously not. It wasn't your thing.
No.
Do you know what? They are...
I can't elaborate more than that. No.
They're very quirky, odd things to get your head around. And once you do, once you plug into it, and which Johnny, without a doubt, would have been able to do, but it takes a bit of time, he would have loved the cut and thrust. Because it's a bit karting-esque.
Yes.
In that it's right on the button. It's aggressive. You haven't got long to do anything.
Nope.
No pit stops. It's just attack. But they are odd to drive, are they not?
They are. The front wheel drive ones. I've never done a rear wheel drive, which I would have thought would be a little bit more logical for me, but still a challenge all the same. I think it was three races I did. Well, it was three. Was it? Was there two or three races over a race weekend? Two races? But I only did three
two
events,
races,
if I remember. Yeah. So I only did six races
and
as a whole. Rockingham. Yeah,
yes.
Rockingham.
Yes.
Yes. That's my best. So, yeah, so out of mind, done. Don't bring it up.
Yeah. Parked in the annals of history.
Indeed.
So, look, we remember Schumacher from karting, and clearly he was, yeah, you know, on his day, he was quite exceptional. But yeah, but he was your teammate. Talk us through that.
Tough. Very, very, very tough. But not my problem. My problem was Flavio Briatore. Was the one who made it very, very difficult. Michael was very much thinking about Michael, and totally understood that when I went there, knew that if the team was wrapped around him, but you were hoping that there'd be a little bit of support from Flavio, because I remember when we had the initial discussions with the contract, it was like, we're a team, we're together, so the constructors is very important, but we need to be able to work together, which means the data is also going to be sort of, you know, free for everybody to have a look at. And then once I get to my second Grand Prix, Michael goes to Flavio, I'll do the whole story. It was Argentina. And as we're walking back on the Thursday practice, we hadn't been there for quite a few years, Michael said to me, he said, Johnny, there's things I do in the car that I don't want you to see. And there's things I'm sure you do in the car you don't want me to see.
And I was like,
but that's sort of part of it, Michael. I think, the data's there for us to try and learn off of each other. Yes, but there's things that I want to keep sort of secret for myself. So we sort of went back to the hotel, went to bed and everything else. And I thought nothing of it. And then got back to the circuit in the morning and blessed Ross Brawn, who was obviously hosting that engineers meeting before the kickoff on Friday. And he basically had said that Michael had asked Flavio that he wanted his data to be taken away from me so I couldn't view it. And Flavio went, okay. Yeah, but Flavio went, yes, okay. So you go back to that contract negotiation and it's all about a team. Well, suddenly that team has completely disappeared.
One person.
And of course, the interesting thing with that story eventually of that weekend and for the rest of the season, he could see mine, but I couldn't see his.
See, that's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was shown to me, but it was all at the corner of the eye, and you had to be in a special moment that you couldn't just analyse it. You sort of had to peer at it and sort try and quickly with your eyes and try and make it your eyes weren't looking elsewhere. So, and then that's a mental game that then comes into play, because you need the support of everybody, and then suddenly you've got the team principal who's not backing you up in any way. And then you feel alone, because then you've got no one to go to, because it didn't matter what I asked for, I never got. And that was where the sharing part of it. Would I have beaten Michael? Probably not. Would I have been closer? Yes. But it just became a real big mental game, which eventually I decided qualifying, I've got to forget about qualifying, because I'm just not going to be able to compete. Yeah. So focus just on the race, which eventually sort of paid off, I suppose. But a good man, Michael.
Yeah, really great yeah, bloke.
Good sense of humour. Great British sense of humour.
Very misunderstood.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. But he never showed it, did he? And that's why. But he didn't want to show it either.
Did he ever rip the back of your trousers off you?
No, he ripped my shirt. Yes, he did the shirt thing, which was always the normal thing he did. Yeah, he ripped every single button off of my shirt. In Adelaide, as it always was. He did your trousers, did he? Trousers. Interesting.
He did, he took a whole trouser leg off down the back.
See, cool. No one knew that, did they? I mean, that's the beautiful thing, is that the public perception that he was so ice cool and so completely focused, yet inside he had this wonderful sort of cheeky, naughty sense of humour. I suppose he never really let his guard down, because that could be seen as a sign of weakness, maybe?
Very much like you, Johnny, and myself. Yes. Very guarded.
Very much. Very much like you. Yes.
Until last orders.
Yeah. We didn't quite do that. I'll tell you one other story with Michael as well. My wife and Karina got on very well in the early days, and we did sort of Brazil-Argentina. We came back to Imola. And my wife was sitting down in the hospitality. Karina came in, said hi. They never spoke for the rest of the year. And I think that was Michael almost, because they're getting on so well, they might find out how I click. So don't mix together.
Oh, really?
And I found that sort of a bit disappointing, actually, that it fed down to to the wives. And then, very, very odd. But then you can't take away what he achieved. You cannot take away what he was.
Part of the makeup, isn't it? Part of his.
It's part of the makeup.
Part of his wiring, yeah.
You know, we see that in some regard with Max. There's a very similar Michael-ish type of mentality that is there. Very different than what Lewis is about. Lewis is a very different animal. You know, it's a bit more pure. It's a bit more, you know, I'll make sure, I know as you remember he said about Anthony, just beat them on the circuit. And that's what he tries to do.
Yeah. So here we go. Let me rewind your memory back to a pretty dull day, I think. I think it was Silverstone in 95. Do you remember much about that?
Vague recollection. Yeah, it was a bit damp. Oh,
it was
a British Grand
Prix.
Morning. Yes.
Was it a British Grand Prix, I think? Was it?
I believe it was. There was a lot of people there. Yes, there was a lot of people there. So, yeah, it was quite difficult getting in the circuit. Yes, I think it was the British Grand Prix. You're right.
Yeah.
Good day.
And how did you get on?
Average? I think I did all right. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, I think it was a bit average. Yeah, to be honest. I took my time. I knew it was going to be a long race.
Come on, what's it like winning the British Grand Prix? What is it like?
It's pretty bloody awesome, to be honest, because it's seeing that sea of fans, especially on the last lap, I remember, seeing that sea of fans standing up, waving in the grandstands on the top of those banks the whole way around the circuit, and of course they're waving those flags for you. But I do also remember when I was a little bit further back, when I was at Lotus, they used to do the same. They were and still are great support for all the British drivers. But seeing that last lap, it made my, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, because it's something that you had been working for so long, and then for it to happen in a Formula One race is special, but to actually have it at your home Grand Prix, and it's Silverstone as well, with all the racing that you've done from Formula Ford all the way through, it makes it pretty amazing. But it was two memories for me, because there was all that getting myself into that position. And then secondly, it was worth all that pain I went through after the accident to actually keep on pushing myself as well. So actually the first thought was about the accident and sort of patting myself on the shoulder and going,
really? Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, that was the first thing. And then actually it was the enjoyment of actually winning the race itself second, strangely enough. But just special, Jason, because it's just one of those wonderful sporting venues that still today is massively special for not just the British drivers, but actually all the drivers that go there, which is nice to hear.
Absolutely.
It's interesting, isn't it? Kind of, you know, going back to what we were saying before, I wonder whether without the accident, whether you would have been the same person, because it did make you have to fight a lot harder, didn't it? You know, I'm not saying that you wouldn't have got there without that, but it's certainly, you know, you were up against it, weren't you? You know, you were against adversity, and who knows how your success would have panned out had that not been the case at Brands Hatch in 88.
Yeah, but at the end, I find it quite interesting, because as a character before the accident, going even back to karting, you know, I was quite shy. I was never really said boo to a goose, and I never really overly mingled with other team principals, let's say, with from other teams. Again, the shyness, I wasn't very sort of, I'm here, I'm Johnny, you should give me a drive. I wasn't like that at all. And then my character, which is probably still there today, changed, is where you've got that happy, chappy, laughy Johnny. And that was because the only way I could get through those very, very early days of, because I went to a place called Feldkirch in Austria. And that's where Tony Mattis, who did a few drives, Keke Rosberg, Nigel Mansell, for example, looked after them in his clinic. And I would literally go into the forest and then climb a mountain to the top, come back down again, climb the mountain once again, and do that sort of four or five times every single day. And my toes, they still don't bend now, my toes didn't bend. So it was so painful. I mean, so painful. Mm. And then once a month, I used to wake up and go, I can't do this. This is just too much. My mind is just
ready to explode because of the pain I was going through. And then I'd sleep the following night and I'd wake up in the morning all fresh and do it all over again. So
reset.
But the only way I could get over it, even at that period, but then when I started racing, was to laugh about it. And that was the way I could get over the pain that I was in every single race, and even to the very last race that I did, especially my right foot, which my toe got dislocated and severed off slightly, and they stitched it back on again, and there's a bit of callus that grows underneath the toe. And it was so sensitive, painful, but I couldn't tell anybody. Because if I told someone, this was through my whole career, if I told someone, I would never have got a drive. So I had to keep that to myself. I never even told my wife, because I didn't want her to worry about it as well. So that goes back to a little bit about the view that we had when we were driving. There's that view. Then there is, that's all you're thinking about. You're not thinking about anything else. But I'm thinking that with about 20 laps to go, I'm going to start to get this painful situation again. So I'm even thinking about, right, how do I get around that? Because at Silverstone, when I won in 95, was trying to work out, how do I get to the end of the race? Because I was, and I'm not lying when I say this, I, for the last 15, 16 laps, there were points when I was braking that I was actually screaming in the car. Because I know I was shouting, shouting, screaming, because it was so, so painful. But then I thought, right, how do I ease that pain? So my left ankle doesn't actually flex very much. So left foot braking was sort of quite new in those days. And I thought, well, the only way I can do it, if I can left foot brake for one lap, I can then go to right foot braking for two laps, then one lap, then two laps. I alternated for the end of the race. So again, that's another extra load of pressure on your shoulder that the other guys haven't got. I haven't got to deal with any of that. Plus, then when I get out of the car, I can't tell anybody about it. It's only I can talk about it now. So there's so much different elements that I was having to deal with. I'll give myself a pat on the shoulder for saying all this, but it was true. I had to find different ways of getting around the problems that I had.
And I would imagine that during that lap at Silverstone in 1995, when you've just won, relatively speaking, it's quite a short period of time. However, within that process, you're effectively summing up in your own head your entire career, are you not? I mean, that's not to say that your career didn't go on to success, because of course it did. But at that moment, I would imagine you've achieved that one dream that you've been striving towards from the age dot. And then as you're going around, you're thinking, I've had the accident, I've come back, I've done what I wanted to do, I've won the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. And you're putting it all into context.
Yeah. But there's one thing missing from it, which is the dream that we had when we were karting. It was to do what, Jason? Yes, it was to drive a Formula One car. Absolutely. It was to be a world champion. That was that was the whole point. It wasn't just being on the grid or being there on a Sunday. It was the world championship. So I didn't achieve that. So I'm frustrated the way that the career went, that I never had that chance in a proper way to try and get that world championship. Would it have been different? I think it would have been, but again, you know, you don't know, because the circumstances could come into play where drivers should be world champion, they never achieve it. You know, Fernando Alonso should be more than two-time world champion, for example, but it doesn't always work out that way. Nigel Mansell should be more than one-time world champion, but he is still a Formula One world champion as well. So the ultimate goal was always the world championship. You know, looking back, I'm very proud that I got three Grand Prix wins. I'm so happy that I got that Le Mans win as well with the Mazda. And then there's been various other formulas that I've done that I've thoroughly enjoyed, except the British Touring Car.
Well, you know what? Funny enough, Johnny, I was going to say this. Ordinarily, we ask all of our guests about their first car and their car history and passing a test and all this. And quite frankly, I don't care. And that's a compliment in so much as this has been such a wonderful insight into an amazing career and the mindset and everything. It's been beautiful. So what I'm going to do instead, Jason, if it's okay with you, rather than going down those normal questions, I want to end here, but I want to end with one thing and one thing only, and I would like a formal apology from you, Jason Plato, for what you did to our guest Johnny Herbert in 2009 at Silverstone in the touring cars. I want, for the first time ever, a formal apology.
And then the first time ever,
because I'm still scarred.
Then we will let this gentleman go.
Johnny, I'm gonna eyeball you straight down the lens. My good friend Johnny, I simply ran out of talent that afternoon and take all blame. I am very sorry for that love kiss at Silverstone.
Okay, I think was that it, Dave? So, was that enough?
That'll do.
Okay, apology accepted.
So listen, with that apology formally accepted, it's a beautiful moment in history. And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Oh, mate, we could sit here and talk all day, couldn't we? But unfortunately, we can't. So that is it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, a big thanks to you. But a huge thanks to our special guest, my old mate, the one and only Johnny Herbert.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Dave. I've had fun, I have to say.
It's been great. It's been a pleasure, Johnny. Thank you very much. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato, at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks, folks, for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Ta-da.